It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll look at an exhibit that explores the culture and history of cycling here in Wisconsin.
First, we're checking in on a story we've been following over the last few months. In January, the Center for Investigative Reporting released information about the Tomah VA Medical Center, including data showing that opiate prescriptions had more than quintupled since 2004, along with accusations of attempts to silence whistleblowers.
Since the story broke earlier this year, there's been a lot of fallout, including a VA internal investigation and five other federal and state government inquiries into the medical center. Aaron Glantz is with us to talk about the latest news surrounding the scandal. He's a reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's the one who broke this story. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So just this weekend, you published a new story on this Tomah VA scandal, focusing on the effect that it had on the local community. How big a ripple effect in the Tomah area was there because of these narcotic prescriptions?
It's huge. It's huge. When you have runaway prescriptions of opiate painkillers, which are, similar to heroin, and you have them going on, as happened for a decade, before someone blows the whistle, it's just breathtaking. The Tomah VA Hospital doesn't just serve Tomah. It serves southeastern Minnesota. It goes up to Wausau and Stevens Point. And we found many, many cases going back many, many years of tragedies that linked back up to the chief of staff of that hospital, David Houlihan, who veterans came to call the Candyman.
Yeah, talk some more about him. Did people make a direct link between what was going on in their community to these overprescriptions and to Dr. David Houlihan?
These were all considered isolated incidents at the time, and it's only after we broke the story of these incredible prescriptions and some of the more recent problems and began to look back into the history that we realized that the VA and Dr. Houlihan were a source of some of these problems. For example, there was the overdose death of Angela Colby 8 years ago. She was a 23-year-old woman. Her boyfriend served in the war in Afghanistan, and she was found 8 years ago in her apartment having overdosed on oxycodone, which she had been snorting. And those pills were prescribed. You can now see in the police report and the coroner's report, which we put up on our website, by David Houlihan. It was considered an isolated incident at the time, but now we know that it wasn't an isolated incident, and it was something that traces back to the narcotic prescriptions that we've been reporting about.
And you mentioned in your piece police saying, well, if this had been heroin, illegal drugs, we would have investigated further. This was a legal prescription, so the investigation stopped there in some cases.
Yeah, it was an accidental death, right? And it was a regrettable tragedy. But what we're seeing in our reporting is not only was it a regrettable tragedy, but it was also a preventable tragedy. And what we have here is, you know, oxycodone is a painkiller. It has legitimate medical usage for people in pain, but it's also pharmacologically similar to heroin, and a lot of people abuse it. And when you have a doctor like Dr. Houlihan and a hospital like the Tomah VA, which is giving out this very dangerous medicine like candy, basically we, the taxpayers, have become a drug dealer. And this went on for a long time. Another incident that we write about in the story happened over 5 years ago where a Marine Corps veteran who was stoned on hydrocodone and tranquilizers that were prescribed from the VA, whose doctor was David Houlihan, swerved and rear-ended an Amish buggy on the road in Marshfield and killed a six-week-old baby. And this is another incident where it got some attention in the media at the time, back in 2009, as a crime blotter item. But when we started to look into it, we saw that it, too, traced back to Dr. Houlihan.
Now, there was a town hall meeting on this, I understand, in the area last week. You've been hearing from individuals in the community who've been affected. What's been the message from the community?
I think that there's been an incredible catharsis since our story came out in January. A lot of people were extremely afraid to speak up a lot of people knew what was going on. You know, the cops knew what was going on. The nurses and other dedicated healthcare providers at the VA knew what was happening. The people who worked as social workers to the courts knew that they kept seeing these guys over and over again, and that Houlihan was their doctor, or that they were getting large doses of narcotics from the VA, that these problem patients' addictions were basically being enabled by our tax dollars. People feel very relieved that this is all out in the open now, and now they're looking for some kind of action. There's going to be a congressional hearing in Tomah, Wisconsin. Two congressional committees together, the House Committee on Veterans Affairs and the Senate Committee on Government Oversight and Homeland Security, which is chaired by Senator Johnson of Wisconsin, are going to be meeting together at the same time in Tomah at the end of the month. And I think people are really looking forward to that, to see what's going to happen next.
And speaking of the Senate, there's been fallout for both senators, particularly Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin. What is the latest we've heard on her staff's response to whistleblowers on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, she dropped the ball. Senator Baldwin dropped the ball. Senator Johnson dropped the ball. Representative Ron Kind, whose district includes Tomah, he dropped the ball. Whistleblowers went to each one of these three lawmakers in the months, and in the case of Congressman Kind, in the years before our story broke, and tried to bring these concerns forward. None of them really did anything about it. Senator Baldwin has been getting the worst of it because she, previous to our story, she was the only official to have seen this secret Inspector General's report, which was completed last March, that showed that these problems existed. The VA did not publish this report on its website or share it with members of Congress, but she got a hold of it in August of last year and basically sat on it. She's since then launched an internal investigation of her staff and disciplined some of her staff, and basically she says that she never actually saw it herself, and that if she had seen it herself, then she would have certainly done something about it. But again, she's not the only politician to drop the ball. And, you know, this is really an incident where we see the incredible importance of the media in bringing things forward when members of Congress from both parties don't respond when their constituents come forward and ask for help.
Now, you're in touch with whistleblowers on this. What is their sense of the congressional response since your story started coming out? Are they happier, not happy, I guess, but more satisfied with what they're seeing from the delegation?
Well, the delegation has really done a lot since the story came up. Both Senator Baldwin and Senator Johnson, Congressman Kind, have been very aggressive in calling for hearings. And, you know, Senator Baldwin called for a criminal investigation. And in addition to the VA's internal investigation that you mentioned, the DEA is involved in investigating these narcotic prescriptions. The state of Wisconsin's medical board is investigating Dr. Houlihan and two other clinicians at the Tomah VA and may pull their medical licenses. So people, whistleblowers, are watching all of this very closely. On the one hand, they're very heartened by all of this response, but Houlihan had weathered a number of scandals before all this became public, and there's still a lot of fear that as soon as the cameras go away and the newspapers move on to another story, that everything will go back to the way it was before.
Before we move on now, Aaron, I wonder about veterans who have been affected by this, veterans who may be hooked now on oxycodone, using tranquilizers, the other medications prescribed here. In all this effort, are people going back trying to find those who have been affected by this scandal and seeing what can be done to help them?
Yeah, it's really, really tough. And one of the things is you have people who are addicted. Like you said, they have become addicts. And a lot of them are very upset. You know, their medication is being tapered down now that Dr. Houlihan is gone. There are people who were getting high doses of morphine now who can't get it. And it's a very dangerous situation that's being created now that we're moving to these reforms. Because, of course, since the government has been the drug dealer here, if we stop dealing drugs, people do have the and try to get heroin. It also, when you have a physical addiction to a drug like this, you just go cold turkey.
Aaron, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Aaron Glantz, reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Tonight after 6, you can hear more about this Toma VA scandal on Reveal, a new radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
As temperatures finally start to warm up across the state, many Wisconsinites are dusting off their bikes and hitting the roads and trails. It's an annual ritual here in Wisconsin, one that people have been doing for about as long as bikes have been around.
It's just one of many proud two-wheeled traditions here in the state. Wisconsin's known for its rich cycling history and culture. Now a new exhibit at the Wisconsin Historical Museum is pedaling into that history to showcase some of the most unique artifacts and stories that have made Wisconsin the biking state that it is.
The exhibit is called Shifting Gears, a Cyclical History of Badger Bicycling. And now we've got two of the exhibit's masterminds with us now. Joe Kapler is the curator for the Division of Museums and Historical Sites at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Joe, hello to you.
Good afternoon.
And Nicholas Hoffman is the chief curator at the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. He's co-author of the book Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State. Nicholas, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here this afternoon.
And Joe, we're going to start with you. Why did you decide to take on Wisconsin cycling history in this new exhibit?
Because Nick wrote a great book. The Historical Society Press was the publisher of Wheel Fever. And so Nick and the staff at the History Museum at the Castle approached a museum staff and said, maybe there's something there with the success of this book. Sales, all the presentations around the state, really well received. And I'm sure Nick could tell you the phone requests never stop coming in for presentations. That's a good indicator that this is really good, fertile subject matter. And frankly, Nick had a lot of heavy lifting in terms of research and content already in hand, already done.
And Nicholas, we'll go to you next. So it's hard to cram, I imagine, more than 130 years of Wisconsin cycling history into just one exhibit. So you focus more on the role that Wisconsin has played in two national bicycling eras. So what role has Wisconsin played?
Well, we've been a leader in both roles. Consistently today, we're ranked by the League of American Bicyclists in the top 10 as a bicycle-friendly state. But if we go all the way back to 1895, the peak years of that first bicycle boom in the United States, Wisconsin was considered by this broad advocacy group called the League of American Wheelmen, the leading state of the West, which means that it was a leader in comparison to Ohio all the way into the West to Oregon and California. We were seen as a state that was really setting an example.
And we've got to start talking about this exhibit. It sounds like it's amazing. Joe, tell us in broad strokes what's in there.
But 24 machines, so everything from bicycles that you may recognize, bicycles that you can't believe someone invented and tried to ride, a monowheel. What in the world's a monowheel? Check out the exhibit and you'll get an idea. And tricycles, and then, of course, mechanical interactives, virtual interactives. You can thanks to the folks at Sarah Cycling Group here in Madison who make those great cycle ops trainer riders. You can virtually pedal the Sparta to Elroy Trail in 32 miles in just under 8 minutes. Or even better, you can be a Green Bay Packer for the day. We stuck a camera on safety Micah Hyde's bike. You know how the players have that commuting tradition in Wisconsin of pairing up with Green Bay children and riding their kids' bikes from locker to practice. And so we have replicated that, minus Micah Hyde's annual salary, of course.
Wow, so some cool interactive stuff going on there. And Joe, for the Elroy Sparta Trail, why is that so significant in Wisconsin's history?
As Nick mentioned, we were a leader in the late 1800s, and we were throughout the 1900s as well. And Sparta to Elroy is the nation's first rails-to-trails segment program, something I think we take for granted today. And Wisconsin being a leader nationally, that's historically significant.
And Nicholas, in this exhibit, what strikes you as some of the most exciting stuff?
Well, I think a lot of people are really excited to see, finally in one place, a very long timeline of Wisconsin's bicycle technology. As Joe had mentioned, we have over 20 machines in the exhibit, and you get to see some really neat, rare things, like a Velocipede from 1869, the first machine that would have been spotted in Wisconsin in January of 1869. It was rode by a man named Joshua Town in Milwaukee. He was riding an iron and wood Velocipede through the city streets. And so you get to see that machine, but we take everything up to present with the 2015 Fatty Wampus by the Badger Cycle Works, which is also a machine for riding in the winter. It's a fat bike. So all the way through the exhibit, you get to see all these great bicycles that have really played a big role in our cycling culture.
And you got the bikes, and you also focus on the manufacturing history. Isn't that right, Nick?
Yeah. I think one of the most impressive installations in the gallery, we have this huge case that is filled with bicycles that were made in Wisconsin. And you won't see that anywhere else. It's gorgeous. They're actually hanging from the ceiling. But it might be things like a Mike Apple, a bicycle that was made in the 1980s in Madison. He was an early frame builder for Trek. And then we also, again, have a Velocipede that resembles the first American patent, which was a Pickering in 1869. And then during the 1890s, Wisconsin really became a leader in the Midwest for bicycle manufacturing. By about 1895, it was one of the top 10 fastest growing industries in the state. So you get to see things like a bicycle made by Julius Andre and Sons of Milwaukee from about the mid 1890s. And it's a gorgeous green bike. It looks like it was made about 10 years ago, but it's just in wonderful condition. The owners at Ride Your Bicycle Shop in Austin, Minnesota, have taken very good care of it over the years.
And we have, by the way, a picture of that Velocipede up on the Central Time Facebook page. And Joe, I don't want to spend too long on the bikes themselves because there's some other stuff in there too, but I understand there's also a bike which is powered by someone pedaling on the inside with their arms?
a monowheel. And so it's a single wheel, all wood manufacturer, and comes from the Neville Public Museum in Green Bay, part of their collection. So they were gracious enough to have it restored before shipping down here for exhibition. And that's there because, A, it's just cool. And people come to museums often to see cool things. But it also reflects that tinkerer's culture with bike builders then and really bike builders today. Experimentation, a little bit about form and design as well as decoration. That monowheel, which is about almost 6 feet in diameter, has all of those elements.
Now, Joe, besides these bikes, since there are lots of cool ones, crazy ones as you were talking about, but what are the other artifacts that you got to bring this exhibit together?
Accessories are, of course, go with cycling, as you can imagine, both the very, very functional. Even in the 1890s, you needed to have your bike lit for safety reasons, and a company in Kenosha, Wisconsin, made a lamp to hang on your bicycle, and it was lit with acetylene, something very flammable, unstable, and we paired that with right here in Madison, Planet Bike makes has excellent LED lights, and so that again it's this comparison contrast with 1890s and today, gear and clothing from some really well known Wisconsin racers such as Tom Schuler, Cycling Hall of Fame member, as well as very recent stories of today. Caitlin Antonow and Cole House are internationally competitive racers, and you can see their Team USA gear in the show.
Nice. And Nick, let's talk about another area that this exhibit deals with, advocacy. And this is, can be a little politically touchy, the space that bicyclists have to share with other vehicles and pedestrians. How do you take up that topic?
Yeah, well, it's something that we look at a lot in our book that I co-wrote with Jesse Gant. We look at advocacy as a really big theme in Wisconsin cycling history. And we always have had a very strong advocacy tradition during those really peak boom years. If we go all the way back to 1869 when the first Velocipede is spotted in Wisconsin. Right away when it is riding through streets in Janesville, Appleton, where it can and cannot ride becomes a very heated, contested issue throughout Wisconsin. Some cities right away actually banned them from riding in their downtown districts or on wooden plank sidewalks. And that's a theme that goes all the way up to the present. Where can people ride? What sort of rules govern where they can ride? And so we look at that quite a bit, mostly through the story of a group that came to Wisconsin in 1885, the League of American Wheelmen. It was our statewide advocacy group. And then also a group that started in 1988 and is very active today, the Bicycle Federation of Wisconsin. And so once again, in the 1980s, after that second boom in the 1970s, we see an advocacy group forming again in the state. So there are a lot of patterns. As ridership increases and becomes more popular, advocacy certainly follows that.
And Joe, this exhibit has been up for a few weeks now. What kind of reaction are you getting so far?
We've opened February and 28th for a reception for all those 20-some lenders who donated, or excuse me, lent items for the show, as well as supporters and donors, and that was a capacity crowd. And I had a photographer from a local media in the gallery the next morning to take some images, and it was difficult because it was too crowded. And so, you know, that's a good indicator.
A good problem.
And so we've had, yeah, really great attendance, which always matters, but then we've had really good feedback. We care very much about attendance, but we also care about the quality of experience. We care about that, and we're getting great feedback, social media chatter, and we encourage people to check it out, and if they like it, to be an advocate on our behalf as well.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Nicholas and Joe, and Nicholas Hoffman, curator of the new exhibit Shifting Gears, and Joe Kaffler, also curator now. And it's this exhibit we're talking about is open at the Wisconsin Historical Museum, runs until early October. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our healthcare system is big and it's complicated. And as the ongoing debate over the Affordable Care Act suggests, there's a lot of room for disagreement. But when it comes down to those basics, there are a lot of things that just seem like common sense, things we can all agree on. We should get our physicals, get screened for common types of cancer. When there's something wrong, treat it as soon as possible before it gets out of hand.
Just one problem, according to our next guest, those and other bits of common sense are often wrong. Worse, they drive us to medical care that's expensive and that can actually make us less healthy, not more.
Dr. H. Gilbert Welch joins us now. He's a professor at Dartmouth Medical School. His newest book is Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. Dr. Welch, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, before we dig into the particular assumptions you're working to try to turn around, it all feels kind of counterintuitive. Are we really in a situation in our healthcare system where we're commonly getting medical care that can do more harm than good?
I think the answer is yes. Many doctors are worried about the problems caused by too much medical care. In fact, a recent survey suggested that nearly one half of primary care physicians believe their patients receive too much medical care. And I want to be clear, some people don't get enough, but we're recognizing that the conventional concern about too little medical care now needs to be balanced by a concern about too much. And I want to be clear, medical care can do a lot of good in selected settings, but it can also harm people in others. And that's why I wrote the book, to try to help communicate those nuances in a sense of balance.
And what drives all of this? As you say, a lot of doctors are worried about the problems of too much care. Is it insurance? Is it pharmaceutical companies? Where is this drive coming from?
Well, it comes from a whole lot of sources. Doctors would say, you know, their first response might be lawyers. You know, lawyers are creating the problems, and lawyers do certainly add pressures to doctors. The economists would say it's about economics, that systems and doctors are paid more to do more, so that leads to too much being done. But it's more than either of those two explanations because of messaging that's been going on over the past 30 or 40 years. The public has been taught and has now sort of written to their hard drive assumptions about the value of medical care that are excessive. And that's part of it was dealing with those assumptions that led me to want to write the book.
Let's start digging into those assumptions now. And the tricky thing is a lot of these really feel like common sense, and you're trying to overcome a lot here. So the first one you tackle is the idea that all risks can be lowered, and I think all risks should be lowered. Why is that a problematic assumption?
Yeah, and again, there's nuance here. Medical care can reduce some risks, and the effort is most likely to be successful when the risk is high. Like, you know, someone who has, in the next 5 years, a 50% chance of something bad happening to them. Medical care can sometimes reduce that kind of risk dramatically, as is the case in people with really, really high blood pressure. But the truth is most of us aren't at really high risk. We're at average risk. Our chance of something bad happening in the next 5-10 years is a matter of 2 or 3%. And it's hard to lower a small risk. And the problem is that almost all of our interventions have the potential to hurt people. And it's when we start trying to reduce risks in people who are already at fairly low or average risk begins to cause problems. And we learned that from being too aggressive with treating people's blood sugar and blood pressure and actually evidence now that we can increase mortality in people, particularly in the elderly.
Well, yeah, you mentioned extremely high blood pressure. Okay, that's a case where some intervention, some medication, say, might be worthwhile.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so we've seen dueling recommendations, though, for people with, you know, slightly high blood pressure, high average.
That's right, and absolutely right. And I think one of the things that people may be getting to get a sense of is that there's a considerable debate within the medical profession, and there is an effort to sort of undergo a course correction now that a few years ago we were much more aggressive about blood pressure control, and now there's a growing set of recommendations that are not as stringent, and I think that's a very healthy thing. And that's again one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is so people understood why we might be pulling back on some of the things we had originally suggested, because we now recognize if we try to reduce all risks, we end up creating risk.
Because the medications involved in this case might have some side effects, I imagine?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely right.
Well, a related assumption is that, hey, if we find anything that's a problem, we should try to fix it. We should try to fix it now before it becomes a big problem.
That's right. And this is really sort of hardwired to our sort of mechanical approach. You know, if there's a problem, let's fix it. If the sink is clogged, let's fix it. And the effort to fix a problem also tends to confer some risk. It tends to mean that we need to do an operation or an invasive procedure to fix problems. And this is probably most dramatic in cardiovascular disease, where, you know, to fix the problem, we're inserting wires and we're blowing up balloons and we're placing stents. And that may be a good thing for someone who's having an acute heart attack. It looks like it is a good thing. But most of these procedures are not being done in people who are having heart attacks. They're doing in people who have angina or maybe just abnormal arteries. Well, now we know from a variety of randomized trials that one in angina doesn't help people live longer or have less angina. And it does have some upfront risks, and then people need to be on anticoagulants. These are the kind of things where you want to say, if the problem isn't that big, you don't want to be fixing it. You want to be managing it. You want to see how it goes. And so it's important for people to ask about options and start slow. You know, don't always go to the most dramatic solution right off the bat. See if the problem can be managed.
And you mentioned the research outcomes and what we can base treatments on. There's less conclusive research on a lot of medical issues that I, as a layperson, would have assumed.
Absolutely, yes. A lot of what we do in medicine doesn't have a strong evidence base. It's hard to get an evidence base for everything, and we're still feeling our way. And that's why one of the reasons, because there's always going to be uncertainty in healthcare, it's one of the reasons that if you don't have a problem that's really severe, you want to make sure the solution isn't more dangerous than the problem itself.
Well, I want to get into an issue you've been talking about for a long time. You've been on our network talking about this before,
yeah.
The idea that it never hurts to get more information, that more screenings, more early screenings, more preventive screenings are always a good thing. Talk
yeah.
about that a little.
Yeah, sure. The assumption that I think you're really referring to is that sooner is always better, and this has been a something that's been bred into people for years, that you want to be looking for early forms of disease, particularly a feared disease like cancer. But our understanding of cancer is changing, and we're recognizing that it's a very heterogeneous group of disorders, and that a lot more of us have it than we ever recognized. And this leads me to what's been called the barnyard pen of cancers. And in this barnyard, there are three animals. There are the birds, the rabbits, and the turtles. And the idea of early detection is to try to fence these animals in. Well, it's hard to fence in a bird because the bird's already gone. It flies away. And that represents the most aggressive cancers, the cancers that are growing really fast, the cancers that have already spread to distant parts of the body by the time they're detectable. The issue there isn't early detection. The question is, can we treat those cancers? The rabbits are hopping around. If you build enough fences, you can catch them. That's where screening will arguably have its best effect. And then there are the turtles. Those are the cancers that aren't going anywhere anyway. And the unfortunate reality is screening's really good at detecting turtles. Doctors don't know which cancers are turtles, so they end up treating all of them. And that means a lot of people can be treated for cancers that are never going to bother them. And the reality is now there are actually a lot of turtles out there to find. About a third to a half of adults will have small thyroid cancers. Around a third of women age 40 to 50 will have small breast cancers, the earliest form of breast cancer, ductal carcinoma in situ. And over half of men over age 60 have small prostate cancers. If we start looking aggressively for these cancers, we'll find them and we'll treat all these people, and that won't be good.
So does it save lives to detect these things early and get treatment before they get out of hand, given that some of them are going to be, as you say, turtles?
This is a burning question, and this is, as many of your listeners will know, it's a considerable debate about whether prostate cancer screening helps a few men or not. Same true with breast cancer screen. Does it help a few women or not? My belief is both do, and it's a very few, on the order of less than 1 per 1,000 screened over 10 years. But it also hurts other people. It leads many to have false positive results, will have subsequent testing, and it leads another group to be treated for cancer unnecessarily and have all the side effects associated with that treatment. That's why screening is a really close call, and that's why it's a choice. It's not a public health imperative. And if you are going to engage in screening, my suggestion is take your time. Now, if you have an abnormal test, take your time. Get a follow-up test in a few months. See if something really is growing. If someone tells you that you have a cancer, take your time. Maybe have another pathologist look at the lesion. Maybe consider the various options and make sure you don't have more treatment than you really need.
We're talking to Dr. H. Gilbert Welch about his new book, Less Medicine, More Health.
And you can join in with your questions and thoughts for our guest. As a patient, a family member, or a healthcare provider, have you seen the problems that our guest is talking about? Do you think we're too quick to try something, medications or surgery? Or have you seen the value of early screenings and preventive care? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. we continue our conversation with Dr. H. Gilbert Welch about his new book, Less Medicine, More Health, Seven Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. He says things that might sound like common sense, like early detections and screening, can actually do more harm than good.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this in your life, maybe as a patient or a family member of somebody who's receiving medical treatment, or somebody on the healthcare side? The gut reaction, test more, treat more, give the prescription, do the surgery. Do you think we've gone too far in that direction? Or do you have a story on the other side where maybe an early detection, you think, made a big difference in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Welch, we heard from Chris on Facebook, who writes, my fiance is a pediatrician. In that field, the majority of healthcare fields, sooner is better. Seeing doctors about issues is better than self-diagnosis or waiting too long. For example, managing diabetes is cheaper and better than waiting to have your foot cut off. What drives healthcare cost, Chris says, is waiting. Instead of something being cheap to fix, it turns into a five-day hospital stay. What do you think about that, Dr. Welch?
Well, there's two issues here. One, does it save money to take an anticipatory approach? And then the second question is, does it help people? And I think the more important question is, does it help people? But let me first deal with the question of saving money. And the issue is, whenever we start looking for early problems, we start involving a much broader group of people. We always then end up finding more patients, and we do a lot more to people. And that's very much been true with mammography. We end up doing more surgery and more biopsies. That does not save money. You involve so many more people in the system. But as I said, the central question is, does it help people? And the truth is, it has a mixture of effects. It may help a few, but it also leads others to be treated unnecessarily. And I know a lot of people will say, well, geez, it's better to be safe than sorry. But one of the questions is, that's really not known, is which is the safer course? Because a lot of people can get involved in medical care and end up in places they do not want to be, facing choices they'd wish they never would have had to face, and suffer from side effects from our interventions.
Another assumption, as we get back to your seven assumptions here, is that action is better than inaction, kind of a do something rather than nothing mentality. How does that get us into trouble?
Yeah, this is the chapter where I deal with surgery, which is the most dramatic action we have in medical care. And in fact, all surgery involves trauma. And of course, that's why we use the term, you need to recover from surgery. And ironically, the surgery can impair the body's ability to heal. Now, sometimes you're acutely injured and you're bleeding internally. You know, you definitely want surgery to stop the bleeding. But one area where there's been an awful lot of surgery where we now realize we've probably gone well over what makes any sense is back surgery. And we now know that, first, the back's an extraordinarily complex place with a lot of little small muscles tying the vertebra together, and back surgery creates trauma to this area and has the unfortunate side effect of taking acute back pain and making it into chronic back pain. And we now recognize that most back pain shouldn't receive back. You know, it's a place where we've done way too much surgery, and we've actually made lives worse for patients. And that the right answer for most back pain is inaction. Not inactivity, but inaction. Watchful waiting, let people be active, not go to bed. And let the body heal on its own. And I think that's just one of the general problems with our belief structures around medical care, is we've sort of negated the body's ability to recover on its own. People get interventions. They believe they got better because of the interventions, when in fact another possibility is they would have improved as well on their own.
We heard from Kim on Facebook. Kim says, I work in ophthalmology, see patients all the time that come in wanting extra testing and so on because they feel their symptoms couldn't be something simple or unexplainable. Sometimes, Kim writes, we have aches, pains, or other symptoms that are just nothing. That's not what the patients want to hear. I think internet access has a lot to do with it. So, Dr. Watch, how much are patients driving this temptation to test and do procedures?
Patients are certainly part of the recipe here. As I said, there's a lot of parts to this recipe. There are lawyers. There's the economic system that tends to pay more if we do more. And then patients have these assumptions, which I'm not blaming them for, because for many ways, this is what they've been taught. There's been messages, whether it's on the internet or whether it's on TV or whether it's on magazines, that sort of systematically exaggerates the benefits of health care and minimizes the harms. I want to come back. Medical care can be really important for those, particularly for those who are acutely ill and injured, what you might call acute care medicine. We can do a lot of good for people. But in many other settings, we have exaggerated the benefits and understated the harms of medical interventions. And so particularly people who feel well, you ought to be very cautious about the medical care system, because the reality is it's very hard for us to make a well person feel better. But even if you are sick, you want to go slow, you want to take time, understand your options. You certainly don't always want the newest thing. You'd rather have things, I think, that are well understood, have an established track record, and safety record.
Now, as we wrap up, it seems like phrases like the one you mentioned earlier, watchful waiting, I've heard that more and more in recent years. Do you think that there's a change in the works in the medical community that may improve these assumptions you've been talking about?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty optimistic that we're in the midst of a course correction in medicine right now. More and more doctors understand these problems. And more patients do, too, and quite frankly, the news media understands them better. And it's all about finding a balance. It's about having a moderation and understanding that, that more medical care isn't always better. It can lead to bad things happening. And so while you want to approach the system when things are acutely wrong, for sure, you want to be much more hesitant when everything is going well.
Well, Dr. Welch, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being with you.
That was Dr. H. Gilbert Welch. He's a professor at Dartmouth Medical School. We've been talking about his newest book. It's called Less Medicine, More Health, 7 Assumptions That Drive Too Much Medical Care. You can keep the conversation going, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page. A poignant bit of music history today. On this day in 1968, Otis Redding hit number one on the Billboard chart with Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay. 3 months after his death in a plane crash here in Wisconsin in Madison's Lake Monona.
It was the first ever posthumous number one hit single, and it went on to win Grammy Awards for Best R&B Song, Best R&B Vocal Performance, too. Some of his other best-known hits include a Try a Little Tenderness, Respect, and a cool cover of Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones.
I really like that Satisfaction cover. And Veronica, you, like me and most people, are a fan of Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay.
It's hard not to like that song, except it makes you want to do just that. Sit on a dock,
watch,
in a bay,
yeah.
Relax.
Exactly. Well, we're going to go out to the news now with Otis Redding's number one hit this day in 1968, Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay.
Sittin' in the morning sun, I'll be sittin' when the evening comes. Watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. More to come here on the Ideas Network.
Georgia, headed for the Frisco.